Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the October 13th, 2014 edition of the Heretics Hour. The Heretics Hour is a continuously running weekly program that premiered on March 1st, 2010, making it 4.5 years running. I would say that's an accomplishment, even if I'm the one saying it. The opening music for this show has never changed. It's from Les Preludes by Franz Liszt. He is considered Hungarian, but his great-grandfather, Sebastian Liszt, was one of the thousands of Danube Swabians migrating within Austria-Hungary in the first half of the 18th century. That is exactly as my great-great-great-great-grandfathers were doing at that time. Franz Liszt was born to German parents, Maria Anna Lager and Adam Liszt, in the German town of Doborzhan, that's a Hungarian name, in Sopron County, Hungary. I just found that out this evening. Now, how uncanny it is that I selected his music for my first radio show. Actually, it was Wilhelm Christman who recommended it to me, and I just loved it, and I still love it. It doesn't surprise me, though, but I just had never checked. When I had read about Franz Liszt, I didn't pick up on that. But now I see that his family was the same as my family, and I don't know where in Germany they migrated from. Maybe I can find that out. But I do feel a great fondness for his music, and particularly this Les Preludes is one of the best things he ever did. So I am continuing from last week's Heretics Hour tonight about the Slavs versus the Germanics, or however you want to put it. I guess I could say it that way. I'm not ever sure how to say it. But instead of introducing the themes I have in mind, as I usually do, try to make an introduction, I'm just going to start right out with a news story that does a great job of setting the tone. And this is something that is from The Economist, .com, from 2013, in September 2013, well, a year ago. And it reads thus: when residents in Frankfurt, an der Oder, park their cars, they know that they may not see them again. Welcome to Germany's car theft capital, where Polish gangs operate a highly productive empire. Frankfurt an der Oder is a different city from the Frankfurt that's the most well known over in the west, in West Germany. This one is in East Germany, and as a matter of fact, it's right on the Oder River. So it's right on the border with Poland, you know, the new border, the post-World War II border. So all they have to do is come across the river to come from where the city in Poland that's on the other side, or the town, into Frankfurt an der Oder. And continuing with the article, you can't generalize and say, quote, the Poles steal because the thieves are criminal gangs, says Uwe Heppe, chief executive of Frankfurt's Chamber of Trade. But the thefts have increased dramatically since Poland joined Schengen. In the past, some 50 cars were stolen here each year. Now it's 350. It's not surprising that car-stealing gangs flock to Frankfurt. Crossing the border takes just a few minutes. Okay, so I already told you about that. And the Schengen is the European Union policy that makes it all European Union, full members of the European Union, are allowed to travel all around the European Union to any EU countries they want to without any approval or any need to get permission or visas or anything like that. So there's no need of papers. they just drive right over, you know, as though they're in the same country. So continuing with the article, Polish gangs stealing German cars is nothing new. What's new is the rapid increase of such thefts in eastern Germany since the expansion of the passport and immigration control-free Schengen area. Well, he was telling you that, and I already tried to explain it. In Brandenburg, the state where Frankfurt is located, which has Germany's longest border with Poland, police recorded 2,700 vehicles for 100,000 residents in 2007. That means stolen vehicles. By 2010, the figure had skyrocketed to 4,055 vehicles per 100,000 residents. Not quite double. It didn't double, but it was getting close to that. And I checked and found out that Poland joined the EU in 2004. So they've been an EU member for 10 years now, and were one of the earlier ones. Not the first ones, but Poland now often just serves as a transit country for the stolen vehicles, which may end up in Russia, Ukraine, or Lithuania. Sometimes things don't go as planned, though. Last year, thieves stole a small lorry. A lorry is Germans call it these vehicles lorries that are like a van or a truck, something you can carry things in, carry a bunch of people in or something. And they stole a small lorry east of Berlin, not realizing it contained 12 corpses in coffins. The vehicle and the coffins, with the corpses inside, were later found in a forest near the Polish city of Poznan. So they just, left that thing when they realized what they had there, and it had to be, just think about those families who those corpses belong to. My goodness, you know, it's not, you know, you might laugh at that, but it's not really funny. Now, Frankfurt's spokesman, Christopher Hirsch, says, we're a border city and we're right by an excellent autobahn. The gang steal paintings, machinery, and gardening tools, too, and recently they stole a bronze sculpture. But he adds, you have to remember that the cars that are stolen here don't all belong to local residents. Sometimes the cars have been stolen somewhere else in Western Europe, but the crime is discovered here. I guess the cars end up there. The thieves' favorite brand is Volkswagen, which is stolen four times as often as other car brands. Brandenburg leaders have lately woken up to the car theft epidemic. In 2010, the state created a special police force, SOKO, or that's S-O-K-O, Grenze, with the task of combating car gangs. Quote, we're talking about groups of 25 to 30 people, which have each stolen hundreds of vehicles in Brandenburg, reports Jens Starik, a police commissioner, and SOKO Grenze's commander. They are extremely professional, but they don't belong to the advanced school of organized crime, and they're not as influential as organized criminal syndicates. SOKO, or SOKO Grenze, fully operational since last year, has a staff of 100 police officers and uses additional officers for special operations. So they're spending money. They're having to spend quite a lot of money to have all those police, 100-plus officers on the payroll, especially for this car thief business and Polish thievery business, because these criminals, which are allowed to be a part of this union, are taking it, you know, doing what they're doing, and Poland is unconcerned about it. Polish officials do not show any concern, so it's all up to Germany and the Germans to try to do something about it. To deter crime, continuing here, and find stolen vehicles, Mr. Streg, who is the head of the commander of the special police force, deploys unscheduled checks by uniformed and plainclothes officers. Soko Grenza investigators gather evidence to send thieves to court and, they hope, jail. There are early signs of success after a small decrease in 2011. Last year, car thefts in Brandenburg dropped to 3,355 per 100,000. It had gone up to, what I say, over 400,000. But residents are not convinced. Yes, they say, yes, the police sometimes catches the thief driving the car, but he's just the little guy in the operation, says Dieter Remmer, who works in a Ford dealership in Frankfurt an der Oder. Besides, after several hours, he gets released again. The politicians have to see to it that we get harsher punishment for these gangs. Yeah, well, this is what we've been reading off and on in Table Talk about Hitler's frustration with judges who are so soft and who use any excuse to or make excuses for the for these criminals that come into their courts and find extenuating circumstances and so on, and don't give them the kind of punishment that Hitler thinks is necessary to keep an orderly society. And it's, of course, we know this is going on. It's a problem in liberal societies. Poland's ambassador to Berlin, Jerzy Margenski, was unavailable for an interview, as was the embassy's press attaché. Reached through his secretary, the spokesman for the Polish police, Mariusz Sokolowski, declined to answer questions in any language other than Polish. But last year, Mr. Margenski's predecessor, Marek Prawda, claimed that it was, quote, too easy to steal cars in Germany. In fact, Brandenburg police has repeatedly scolded German car owners for being naive. They simply park their cars in the street, laments Mr. Strake. An easy step would be to install an immobilizer. It won't prevent a theft, but it will make the theft take more time, and time is something the thief doesn't have. Well, you know, this part really tells you the story here, how this is so typical of what we find. The victim here, the Germans, are blamed for making it too easy to steal their cars. It's like it's up to them to make it more difficult. It's up to them to buy expensive equipment, something that they can install in their car that won't actually prevent a theft, but it will make it a little bit more difficult. And that, it's up to them to do that, not up to the police or anybody to stop these crooks, and when they do, to give them very harsh sentences. Nope, this is the way it goes. So somehow it's the Germans' fault because they don't protect themselves well enough from thieves. For his part, Mr. Hirsch lauds the Frankfurt police's novel theft-solving technique known as artificial DNA. It contains a code specific to the owner, and when the Polish police discovers the car, they can identify the code with a special instrument. It's an impressive tool, but it hardly deters thefts. In fact, many residents point out that it doesn't help them if a stolen car is identified as theirs. Most likely, it's already damaged, causing their insurance premiums to rise again. So, it's a problem that just once in a while catching some of these people or recovering the car for the owner is not really satisfactory, and their insurance premiums go up because of it. So, I've only got another paragraph, so I'll finish this, then I'll comment. Some Brandenburgers feel that Poland was prematurely allowed to join Schengen, or join the Union. But shutting the border? That would be wrong, they say. We're one Europe, explains Mr. Bremer, a German. But the police needs more powers, and I believe the Polish economy needs help. You have to understand the thieves. They're jobless, and when their unemployment benefits expired, they turned to auto theft. If it were you or me, we'd probably do the same. Well, isn't that a very typical understanding German? Not blaming those who are stealing from them, not blaming those who he sees as being less well off. They therefore have a right to come and turn to crime if they've lost their job. This really gets me, and this is an exact replica of what goes on in other countries with other people, foreign people, and that here in the United States with Negroes, with Mexicans, they're given excuses because they're poorer, they don't have a job, this and that. Well, you know, in this case, the joblessness of Poles is no one's problem but Poland's. It's not Germany's problem. Should not be. But see, Germans will take that on. And this is one of the problems that you find in Germans, that Hitler and the National Socialists and Goebbels and were so aware of and were working so hard to correct and toughen up Germans and help them to see that they had rights and to stop being so sympathetic to those who were out to harm them, really, and to, you know, see things as they were. But it just really drives you batty to see people behaving like this. Instead of being righteously indignant and angry and wanting to have something done about it and stop these Poles from coming into the country at all, if they're going to come in and steal, well, they don't. They say, oh, well, you know, they don't have any money, so they have to turn to that. And so that's an excuse. This is an example of, as I said, it fits every kind of what you'd call underprivileged person or group that can claim to be that all over the world, saying, you know, that making excuses when it comes to something as bad as crime. And here, what right, you know, the Polish government, look at here, it said in here that the Polish ambassador to Germany and maybe to Brandenburg and his assistant and so on, his press attaché, they wouldn't talk, they couldn't be reached. The other Polish government people won't talk about it. The Polish police aren't doing anything about it. Well, I guess when they find these cars, you know, the Germans have to identify all these things, and then if they find one in Poland, they'll do something about it. But you know, it's just the typical stuff, and this is what I'm giving as something of an example, and it is an example, and it's not far-fetched either. Good example of how the Slavs treat the Germans and any other Western Europeans, but they're on the border with Germany. So in Germany, they've been in conflict to some degree over the many centuries, and so there is this that continues to go on, and these underlying resentments and senses of entitlement and so on that exist, and feelings of guilt that have been instilled into the Germans to make excuses and so on. And so there we go. Well, you know who sent this to me was Marcus, and I'm really glad that he did. He also wrote a little something to me, and I'm going to read it to you. This was like a little over a week ago, but he said that he had something he wanted to say, but he didn't want to write it in a comment. He didn't want to write too many comments at my site, so he wrote it to me, and he said, who is facing extinction? Britain, France, Germany, Sweden, Anglo-Saxon America, and Canada are. The Slavic nations are pretty much what they were 50 to 100 years ago without replacement level immigration of non-whites. White guilt is also not pushed in Poland or Bohemia, that is Czech Republic, he's calling it Bohemia. Instead, we hear German guilt from there. What do they do to help Westerners? Demand reparations forever. European Union subsidies. They claim the moral high ground regarding Germany, Austria, and they either take away jobs in Western Europe or apply for welfare if they live in Belgium, Denmark, or Britain, and so on, which weakens the indigenous Western Europeans, and then transfer the money to their countries. The extra money that they make, they send back home. Marcus goes on, or Western capitalists transfer Western companies to Eastern Europe, which creates unemployment in the West and employment in the East. And then they say Merkel is Hitler for taking over Europe with investments that benefit them. What kind of support is that for many Slavs? And is that even a reasonable thinking? It would be one thing, he ends up, if it were only the sheeple in Slavic nations who behave along those lines, you know, only the ones who are, you know, mainstreamed. But are the enlightened white nationalist Slavs any different? Whether Hitler friendly or Hitler haters? Well, I thank Marcus for this too. I think that's very good. I think it sums up a lot of what is really true. And the way that I see it also, you get a little tired of people taking advantage and claiming that you're the one that's hurting them, or you did hurt them or something, and now they, you know, you owe them and you owe them. You get pretty tired of that. I'm going to continue now I've got a lot of interesting things, I think, to say, and on the view that Hitler was anti-Slav or that Hitler hated Slavs. I mean, this is so often said by Slavs. It's mostly Slavs who come up with this, but not always. For example, Bob from D.C. said it last week on this program, and he's not Slavic at all. Well, I have another one here, Frederick. I don't know how he pronounces his first name, but Frederick Reichardt, the Dutchman, who is also in that same camp, accusing Hitler of anti-Slavism and Slavic genocide and so on. And they make a big deal that this is such an important part of Europe, you know. Oh, they're such an important part of Europe, and these are Europeans. And in white nationalist thinking, Europeans don't hurt other Europeans. Well, I retort that Slavs were anti-Hitler also. And if you tell them that, or they deny it, or they will blame it on Hitler and say, well, he caused them to be anti-Hitler or anti-German, or the Germans, even earlier than Hitler, caused the Slavs to be anti-German, and it's never the Slavs' fault. Now, first, Slavs and Germans are different groups of people with long histories together, and they do not have the same interests necessarily. This is something I have to emphasize, and people forget because they want to say, well, we're all white. This is what this white nationalist thing is. We're all white. We all have the same interests. Well, in the largest, broadest perspective, you can say, okay, our interests are to keep Europe free of non-whites. Then, of course, we also would like to get the not have Jews in Europe. Or a lot of people would just want to get rid of the Jews what they consider bad Jews and ignore all the rest of the Jews. That's okay. But this is supposed to be something we all have in common, and it's supposed to be our common homeland, and that's what the European Union is functioning on, that this Europe is a common homeland. The whole Europe is a common homeland to all Europeans. I'll just throw in here, because I don't really have this as part of the program, but point it out, you know, specifically. But Europe, the European Union keeps expanding. Well, they have, they've gone about as far as they can go now, but they had kept expanding that which they considered to be European enough to join their union, and it goes right up to Russia, and Russia doesn't want to be a part of it. And I don't know how that Europe would want that either, but they want all those other countries that are butting right up against Europe, and I mean against Russia, and that Russia considers that it has an interest in those areas. And they're all joining the European Union, and I think that some of these should not be invited to join. Not that I care about the European Union, but, you know, just on principle, I don't think they should be a part of Europe. They're going to do a lot of harm to it, and maybe that's all right. But in any case, these differences that we have a long history, and our groups have long histories together, particularly nations that are bordering one another, and they do not have the same interests necessarily, I already said, and we're bound to differ, and we have to work out our differences through diplomacy or through war, through coming to some agreement or accepting some kind of concessions, or through going to war. And the German-Polish War was one of these instances when diplomacy failed, and finally it came, there was nothing to do but have a war. And it should have been a German-Polish War and been done with, but it was turned into others joining in or declaring war on Germany, and then turned into World War II, which was a horror. And that cannot be blamed on Germany for going to war with Poland, who was anxious to go to war but thought that it would be having the help of France on the other side, and then Britain coming in on it. So, but that didn't happen. You see, those two countries didn't come to the aid of Poland. And yet Poland still wants to be angry at Germany and friends with those countries, you know, at that time. Now they want to be friends with Germany because they've got everything going their way, and they're happy with their situation and all their territory and all their privileges and so on. And Germans are an easy touch for Poles and Poland, and they give them a lot of help and financial help. And so, you know, it's kind of disgusting to see how that works. If you are a pro-German person, if you identify with your Germanness and care about it. So if you're a Slav, you care about, or if you're a Pole, let's say, you care about Poland's well-being and Poles, and I think that's perfectly the way it should be. If you're German, you care about, you look at things from a German point of view, and you care about German interests. And this is the way it is, and I don't see any way, considering the eons of human nature, that somehow we're going to care about one another. But they've got the Germans. We've already seen this German, a man who was, maybe that's why they put in his comment. Maybe they don't put in the comments of those who don't feel this way. You can't blame the thieves if they don't have a job. That's what they have to do. That's really stupid. Now, saying those things, I will bring up a few little examples here of people who are pro-Polish and believe that Hitler was anti-Slavic and hated Slavs and therefore was a bad person, because not a white nationalist, because he wasn't loving all the white people. So even though the Poles were not loving all the white people either, and none of these Slavic countries are loving all the white people, and particularly back at that time, in different instances, you know, people ally together and fight with some of the others. They're not loving all the white people, but it's only Germany who's accused of this. Now, Daniel S. at Majority Rights website is one of these who believe this way, and he wrote something over there, I think it was just posted this morning or maybe yesterday, in response to last week's show, really, because he said he was going to write more about it and my show, and the previous Saturday show title. And his article is titled "Black Lies in White Nationalism," and it goes on that in which he posits that black lies are being circulated in white nationalism. And two lies that he lists here are: Hitler did not instigate the war, and Hitler only modestly sought territory wrongly appropriated by the Versailles Treaty, and Hitler was just trying to get it back. And that's all Hitler was about. Well, I certainly believe the first one, and halfway believe the second one. But he then says, this is how he explains in the beginning. He says, those claims are demonstrably false from the beginning of Mein Kampf, which is, and he quotes this, and it's actually the second paragraph from the very beginning of Mein Kampf, in which Hitler writes, people of the same blood should be in the same right. The German people will have no right to engage in a colonial policy until they shall have brought all of their children together in one state. When the territory of the Reich embraces all the Germans and finds itself unable to assure them a livelihood, only then can the moral right arise from the need of the people to acquire foreign territory. The plow is then the sword, and the tears of war shall produce the daily bread for the generations to come. And then Daniel writes his long essay, mostly attacking Marcus. Anyway, the problem here is that in this paragraph, and this is, Mein Kampf was written in, 1922? Hitler was speaking about foreign colonies. Did you notice that? Colonial policy and foreign territory he was speaking of were foreign colonies such as the British, French, Dutch, and others had. And Germany had a couple of colonies in Africa, which were taken away from them by the Versailles peace plan and all the punishments that were given to Germany. That was one of them. So, you know, it's not even having anything to do with the policy of Lebensraum in Eastern Europe or something like that. So he's missed the boat right here. I just wanted to point that out. And I sent that to Hadding Scott, the link to that, and Hadding wrote to me, and he wrote this and sent me a little stuff I think is pretty good, so I'm going to read it. He said, the ignorant fool, he was referring to Daniel. Daniel relies on the old war propaganda argument of using Mein Kampf, written in 1923 to 1925, to prove what Hitler's intentions were 16 years later. The actual pattern of what Hitler did, that's right, he wrote the second part a little bit later, part two. So, the actual pattern of what Hitler did in 1939 is not what he described in Mein Kampf. Hitler did not, for example, plan on going to war against France. Which is what eventually happened. He talked about containing France, and he certainly didn't want war with Britain. It was the British that goaded the Poles to be intransigent toward the Germans and thereby essentially caused the war. But behind Britain, the FDR administration was pulling the strings. And he's got an article about that on his blog. Was Hitler responsible for World War II? If you want to go and look for that. Sometime, and then he quoted from Heinrich Hertel, who wrote this in 1965, and Hertel was a National Socialist ideologue, and Hertel wrote, when the mea culpus, when you're making excuses, when the mea culpus of the post-war Federal Republic of Germany wished to prove the sole guilt of Germany for the war with Russia, they begin, like the Nuremberg prosecutors, with Mein Kampf. There it can be read in black and white that this Hitler, already in 1924-25, had decided to solve the German need for space, the mismatch of greater population and smaller territory. See, because in Germany, you have to remember then, they had a larger population than some of the countries around them, but a smaller territory to live in, whereas other countries with smaller populations were given more territory. And this was done at the Versailles Treaty. This was this that's where this was done, forced on Germany. And so going on to what Hertel wrote, and that Hitler would conquer the sparsely settled Russian territories with sword and plow in an eastern campaign of the Germans. It might, however, be a monstrous overestimate of the genius of this man if one construes a direct causal relationship between the theories of in 1924 of the youthful leader of a ruined fringe party. That was the when the I think means when the did the failed putsch and had to go to prison and the party was disbanded, and the foreign policy situation of 1941. Later he explained, if I had suspected in 1924 that I would become Chancellor of Germany, I would never have written the book. So what he wrote in 1924, you cannot say that that was his same thinking in 1941. And we've talked about that on the Table Talk program, too, that people who want to insist that Hitler believed this, that, and the other thing, and it's all from the very earliest, either from Mein Kampf or from his very early speeches, not from any of the sources in the 40s, say, especially. So going on with Hertel, he writes, just the difference between the Russia of Lenin on the brink of chaos and crippled with famines and the megalithic Stalinist empire of 1941 shows the absurdity of this interpretation. The Eastern settlement theories in Mein Kampf presuppose a Russia collapsing from its own weakness. Again, Hadding has translated, I think he translated, but anyway, it's posted, was posted there in 2010. Hitler's policy toward USSR justified, and where he's got these quotes from what Hertel wrote. You see, it's basically the Russia of 1920s, early 1920s, was a very different place than the Russia of 1941 that Hitler went into. And you can't think that he just thought he could go in and take over at that time. There are other reasons, and I'm going to cover those if I can get to them. Boy, time is going by already. I don't know. I might have to have a three-hour show tonight. I'm going to skip Franklin Reichert's comment because there's not much point to it and go on to say that some suggested reading from the German point of view exists at Winter Sonnenwende, or at the Scriptorium, and I'll give a link to that on the program post. But I'm not going to talk about these. But if you know, whatever, however you look at this situation in Europe in World War II, you're looking at it from one point of view or another. You're either looking at it, you know, there's the German point of view, which I come from. And then there's the Polish point of view. They, you know, they have their own, and they're going to see it differently. And I guess I used to think that people should, that I had the facts or, you know, whatever, and so people should, that I was right and people should see that. And lots of times, though, they will say things that are definitely not factual. Just like Hadding just pointed out some sort of a stupidity that Daniel came up with. But I realized more and more that that there's just going to be differences. People are not going to accept a version of history that they don't, that they think it doesn't help them, and they're not going to do it. And they're going to look for what gives the version that they like, and it's going to seem convincing to them. And this all is what I like and seems convincing. So I'm going to mention just three of them: the Czechoslovakia Within is a article or book translated there. These are all things that were written in German and have been translated. That exists there. And Death in Poland, which many people are familiar with, The Fate of the Ethnic Germans by Dwinger, and that's there. And Poland from the Inside is another one, written by Colonna too. And then there's a fourth one, The Unknown History of the 1939 German-Polish Conflict, A Brief Synopsis by by someone with the initials WR. And these were all written back in the 40s and not 30s. So I was looking at those before the show, so I thought I'd mention them. Now, I'm going to go to start out talking about Hitler and Poland, and then I'm going to talk about Serbia. I'm going to first read this paragraph about the German-Polish Non-Aggression Pact, which was signed between Poland, the Second Polish Republic, and National Socialist Germany in 1934. And Hitler was very happy to have this signed with the head of Poland at the time, Pilsudski, who he liked and felt he could work with. Pilsudski was suspicious of the Russians. They had had a war, the Russians and the Poles, which the Poles happened to win that one, and so the Poles were feeling pretty good about themselves. They signed together a non-aggression pact. It wasn't a treaty or anything. It was just, you know, that they wouldn't attack one another, and it stipulated the agreement of both countries to put an end to their problems by creating bilateral negotiations. They also agreed to forego their armed conflicts for 10 years. In effect, this has normalized the relationship between Germany and Poland, which became quite strained because of the border dispute caused by the territorial settlement indicated in the Treaty of Versailles. So after World War I, when they changed the borders, already they took away part of Germany and gave it to Poland. And they put a lot of German people who were living there. These were all Germans living in these areas that were on the German side of the present border, you know, the previous border. And now they were in Poland. And they didn't have any choice. And all their, you know, their property and so on was all in Poland. And they were, I believe, the largest minority in Poland. It was known that the extra territory that Poland was given contained peoples from other nations. See, this is where these stupid, whether it was on purpose or by stupidity, these world changers during and after World War I and the same time the Allies in World War II, they were called the Allies then too, were just thought that people didn't matter. You know, I mean, people's identification didn't matter. And they could just stick people anywhere. And they wanted to reward Poland, and they wanted to reward the Czechs. So they created Czechoslovakia, too, in the same way, and put all these Germans, stuck them in that country, ruled over by the Czechs. And they were both very bad rulers, not only of the German minority, but of all their minorities. So this was a situation. And there was a lot of disputes because of it. It was always a big mess, you know. And because of the peace treaty, Germany has recognized the borders of Poland. And so Germany had no choice but had to recognize these borders. And they attempted to end the customs war that only damaged the economies of both countries. So Germany was trying to make do with this. But the fact was that the Germans, with the German people within Poland, were being persecuted all along. Now, I'm now going to go through this chapter from Ein Anderer Hitler, written by Hermann Giesler, and is Fateful Decisions and Decisions about Poland and Russia that I talked about last week. And I'm going to go through that now because I think it does a very good job of presenting what Hitler was trying to do. This is in basically directly from Hitler to Giesler, and Giesler wrote it in his memoir. And, of course, it's on my website, too, so I'll give a link to that in the program post also. But I'm just going to start out here a little bit after it actually starts with one evening, he, meaning Hitler, and this is Giesler speaking here, one evening he talked about the beginning of the war, indicating what thoughts had moved him in August 1939 to the pact with Stalin. August 39 is non-aggression pact between what's called the Ribbentrop-Molotov pact. He wanted to prevent the menacing encirclement of Germany and saw that agreement as the last chance to peacefully solve the Danzig and Corridor problems. Now, the Corridor was a narrow strip, a land strip, that connected Germany that was reduced in size from the Versailles Treaty, to the East Prussian province, which it was separated from by this land that had been given to Poland, taken from Germany. So they couldn't get to it except by sea. They couldn't go through Poland, so they wanted a narrow strip of land, and that was this corridor. And also the city of Danzig, which, you know, was 99% German, and yet was put under Polish authority, although it wasn't considered a part of Poland. It was like an international specials area or something. So it goes on for years. Hitler said, he tried hard to win Poland over for a fateful European Union. It made good sense that Poland should participate in a defense wall against Bolshevism. Every Polish division, he went on, would mean strengthening the military power against not only a possible, but now already significantly obvious onslaught of Bolshevism against Europe. But the people responsible for Versailles were able to masterfully drive a nearly invincible wedge between Germany and Poland. Danzig and the Corridor. They talked about self-determination at Versailles, but they didn't really live up to it. So Wilson's 14 points, which included self-determination for all people, was not applied to Germans. And that Poland, going on, that Poland had to have a free access to the Baltic Sea was for Hitler self-evident. He therefore tried to reach a settlement along that line and diffuse a poisonous tension in their relationship. It was by no means in our interest to share borders with Soviet Russia, so he was happy to have his agreement with Poland, and he signed it, the one with Marshal Pilsudski, Joseph Pilsudski, and he saw a lot of value in that. He's very happy with that agreement. That was a 10-year peace pact, and you already talked about that. But Pilsudski's admonition to his people, which was before he died, he had given this advice, you know, in some speeches and stuff, to keep the door open for further talks with Germany. He felt that, you know, that Poland needed to have talks and negotiations and keep that going with Germany. But that collapsed under the promises and chauvinistic agitation of the Allies, because Pilsudski died suddenly. And Hitler, up until March 1939, hoped to reach a settlement with Poland and even sign a friendship pact. But Chamberlain's guaranteed declaration deemed that hopeless. Poland was in the West camp then, and Hitler saw an agreement with Russia as the only chance to avoid encirclement by the Western powers. So all this is going on in 1939. Hitler is trying to reach an agreement with Poland, but this is so well established and so well known. But Britain and France too are making that are interfering with that. And then Chamberlain came out with this guarantee that if Germany attacked Poland or something, that they would come to Poland's rescue. And that emblazoned Poland to not want to come to an agreement with Germany about Danzig in the corridor. And they refused to do it. It said, you know, that Hitler felt that his offer to the Polish government was not only magnanimous, but reached the utmost limit Germany could bear, and that only he could make such an offer because he was at that time so popular in Germany, and the German people would accept something which was not really in their best interest. This agreement gave too much to Poland, but Hitler was willing to do it in order to keep peace on his eastern border. So he felt that he had gone as far as he possibly could go. But the Poles were keeping their sense of injustice alive or something, and they felt protected by the guaranteed declaration. Giesler says that today Hitler is convinced that Stalin was part of those warmongers with England and France, and that as he calculated, Stalin was quite the calculator. he was driving a double game, a binding treaty with Germany, while at the same time winking at the Western powers, letting them know that he really would be happy if they would attack Germany, and he would just stay out of it. And he had this, they had this agreement. Already at that time, Hitler felt the currents of reaction as real. Reaction in Germany, he means, not only of military, but also those with diplomatic and church connections. So as Hitler's trying to do his foreign policy, he realizes that there is resistance and not helpfulness within Germany, now in the military and also in the diplomatic corps and in the church. But it didn't dawn on him, Giesler says, to what villainy that scum out of the German population might be capable. And the scope of the malicious behavior combined with the foolishness and total misjudging of the actual world situation appeared only later, revealed by the assassination, which was the failed 1944 Valkyrie plot. That he didn't really, according to Hitler and Giesler, he really didn't understand the extent of this reactionary, what he called reactionary, element in Germany. He thought that he's always doing his best to persuade all the different groups in Germany to work together and to, for the good of the nation, and particularly to win the war, and for the war aims, because that was necessary before they could go further. He thought that he had won people over more than he did, because they would act like, particularly in the military, they acted like they agreed with him or they accepted what he was saying. And he could deal with the church and he could deal with the diplomats, but he didn't know the extent of how much treason was in the diplomatic corps either. So that could be that would be the failing of Hitler if you see it that way. He was he believed too much in the German people. He had to, because that's about what he was functioning on. And so but then there was this last massive snub by Ambassador Lipsky, and that mentioning that what that was when Hitler, right towards the, in August 1939, gave an ultimatum finally. They were having meetings and the Poles were not really showing up or behaving, doing what they said. And Britain was assuring Hitler that that they meant to, that everything was okay, that they wanted to come to an agreement. So finally Hitler told the Polish ambassador to Germany to bring such and such information or whatever, and to come to a meeting, bring to him the answer to Hitler's points that Hitler had put out. And Lipsky didn't even show up, never did show up. So this was a real insult to Adolf Hitler, and this is at the end of August 1939. And there's an article also at a part of this one, called Hitler's Final Offer to Poland's Joseph Beck. And you can go there and read all the details of that at my website under the Ein Anderer Hitler. And I'll give the link to that too. But I'm not going to go into that right now because I don't have time. I'm just going to go on here with saying that Hitler gave this was what Hitler gave to the Poles, that he said was his final offer to the Poles to settle the questions between them. One, the German claim for Danzig is justified because Danzig is a German city. So he felt that he had to get Danzig. And two, which shouldn't have been a big problem for the Poles at all, because they had another port city, which they really used more. I forget the name of it right now, but they had developed it. So they didn't need Danzig for their access to the sea. They had another one there. Danzig was a German city. So, number two, the settlement of the corridor question is necessary, and the request for a plebiscite is correct. So Germany wanted this corridor, and they wanted to have a vote, actually, of the people of Danzig, if they wanted to go with Germany or Poland. And, of course, it was pretty clear that they would vote for Germany, which they did when they ever had an opportunity to vote. And three, the alternative offer of the plebiscite for a final and peaceful settlement represents the utmost limits of what can be expected from Germany. That, again, is what I already covered, but they, Germany wanted, was trying to make the point that they had given all they could give, and they just couldn't be expected to give any more. And four, after signing the German-Russian Treaty, Poland's military situation was hopeless. Poland should recognize that with Germany and Russia having a treaty together, that Poland really was not going to be able to get anywhere militarily. But, of course, Poland was depending on France and England. And now five, England's guaranteed declaration did not change anything, nor did any additional far-reaching assurances by England and France. Between the two power blocks of Germany and Russia, Poland would be smashed in a few weeks. So that goes along with number four, that he's telling the Poles that these offers of assistance from England and France are not going to really help Poland because of the agreement between Germany and Russia. And so Poland really needs to accept this for its own good. It'll be better for it. It doesn't really have any choice. But then Giesler says something else countered those facts and encouraged the Poles in their attitude. It was either an English perfidy. See, all they knew at the time, they didn't know everything at that time, but they realized it was an English perfidy which made the Poles risk a war, or the English hint of an assured regime collapse, the removal of the war threat by a reactionary clique within Germany, followed by a putsch. So that was that's referring to the fact that there was this element in Germany that was telling the Poles, and mostly though probably the English and maybe the French, that they should not make an agreement with Hitler because they wanted to get rid of Hitler, and they should not make an agreement with him that if they attacked Germany, Germany would collapse. They would certainly collapse. They would take over, and then they would have a different attitude toward everyone. Hitler had said to Giesler that this was wishful thinking that could explain that they thought the allies thought that the German reactionary was saying, if you remain tough, we will get rid of him. That's what I was just describing. And so they were being encouraged, that Poland was being encouraged to not give in and not sign this agreement. And the English were thinking, we're going to finish off Germany and the Nazis by using the Poles. And the Poles were thinking, if that's so, if there would be a regime collapse, if we hold firm and attack, then we're going to be in a few weeks, we're going to own Berlin. And that's what they always wanted. So this was really warmongering on the part of Poland, Britain, and France. France was pretty much going along, but it's hard for me to know just how important they were. We always think it's England, basically, but they're all three there. They're all warmongering against Germany. Germany was trying to hold the peace, and they really wanted war. Well, but they worked it out so that it would look like it was Germany who wanted war, because it was Germany that was finally fed up. And at the same time, the brutality against the German minority in Poland and in the corridor and the border areas that I've mentioned earlier, the brutality by the Poles had been going on for all along, but it had increased and gotten very, very intense in the recent month. And this had affected Hitler terribly, Giesler says. I believe that. He knew about all that. And he had been trying to accept all that persecution of Germans so that he wouldn't, bring this whole problem to a head with a war. And he was trying to work things out diplomatically and get some control there in the corridor, and get a corridor and get Danzig and, help the situation of the Germans there that way, but they wouldn't allow it. And so that's another reason why they were not reasonable at all. And this atrocities against Germans was very real. And this played a big part in Hitler finally saying that since it was two things. The Poles snubbed him by not coming to the meeting and not answering his 5 points, what was called, they call it his ultimatum, and just letting him sit there and not responding while the English were playing a lying game by telling the Germans that the Poles were sincere and they were going to respond to this and they wanted peace and they were at the same time telling the Poles not to respond to it and not to do anything, not to agree to anything. And at the same time, the United States was telling Britain to make sure that the Poles didn't respond to anything and wouldn't go along with anything. So when all this, you know, finally Hitler saw that this wasn't going to change, this situation wasn't going to change, he told his commanders to invade, to go into Poland, and that was the start of it. That was it. He was, in that sense, forced into it. They wanted him to do that. And the Poles, who thought they were going to have a win and the French would come and attack Germany from the west, they were disappointed in that, and they were shocked to find out that they were being decimated and defeated by this very strong German army, and it took a couple of weeks, and they were done for. And all they've done is cry victim ever since about that, and cry and cry and cry about what was done to them by these terrible Germans. All right, now that was Poland. Now, the invasion of Russia, the same thing, you know. Hitler, it's been said that Hitler should never have invaded the Soviet Union. That was a crazy thing for him to do. He couldn't possibly win. So Giesler said that Hitler then talked again about the German-Russian agreement and that it protected our back. That was the non-aggression pact. We were able to win time. But Stalin, too, needed to gain time when he signed the pact with us. By its guaranteed declaration, England made any rational and peaceful settlement impossible and wanted war. That was with Poland. But Stalin, too, he says, drove toward war without being involved right away. Unrest within Europe and Germany's weakness was his goal. And on that, he made very smart chess moves that were aimed at getting us deeply involved in the war, and Russia would take the advantage. Giesler says those are the old czarist, now Lenin-Stalin, political aims. By the partition of Poland, the Soviets gained their western forefield. And he points out more than once that what we think of as Soviet was the same as the way they behaved in the czarist times, under the czars and under Peter the Great. The same kind of tactics that they used. And, you know, we're always hearing that, when you say Russia under Lenin and Stalin from 1918, no, it wasn't Russia. Those aren't Russians. That was Jews. It was all Jews. Well, it was still Russia. And by the time Stalin had taken over for a while, he had purged a lot of the Jews. And while he still had a lot of Jews and in areas, police areas and so on, certainly there were a lot of Jews there. But it was a lot of Russians too, and it still behaved in the traditional ways and did things and thought in the traditional ways that Russia did. And the Germans almost always talked about that nation they were at war with as Russia, not as Soviet Union, even though they knew it was the Soviet Union, because they still knew that the people were Russian and were thinking, acting like Russians. I'll leave that there. Giesler writes, while we were tied down with our forces in the West, the Russians, and next the Baltic states, occupied Bessarabia and northern Bukovina. They were not squeamish, they turned spheres of interest into annexations. Well, you know, it is true that when Germany and Soviet Union made their agreement, their pact, it was acknowledged by Hitler that the Soviet Union would have had interests in the Baltic states, Bessarabia and Bukovina, and also some other places. And Hitler accepted that because he had to accept that to get this agreement. And then he had, I don't know if he announced certain spheres of interest also, but they weren't supposed to take them over. But they're saying that the Soviets actually annexed these areas then on that, based on that agreement that was an area of interest for them. Stalin was waiting for his time. You know, he wasn't innocent. He was laying in wait to see when the time would come when he would be able to invade Europe. He thought he wanted to see Germany and Britain fight it out. Giesler writes, Stalin, and here again he brings this up, says, Stalin, no, Russia, since Peter the Great, wanted still more territory. Russia wants the Balkans as a sphere of interest, naturally, like the Baltic states. Russia intends Bulgaria as a sphere of interest. It would give her access to the Aegean Sea, and Russia wants bases at the Dardanelles. So Stalin's demands now went from Finland to the Aegean Sea as a basis for the Bolshevik World Revolution. That's what they were seeing then. That's what Hitler was seeing then. No longer then did this agreement that they had really hold, because the Soviets, Stalin was taking advantage of it and going beyond what had been agreed to and was taking over these areas. Giesler says, had Hitler agreed to what Molotov demanded in the name of Stalin, at one point Molotov came to Berlin and gave him some demands from Stalin, and Hitler was shocked. He was shocked by it. And they got very aggressive. And as soon as they, you know, as soon as they see that they have an upper hand, and Hitler's having trouble with some other nations, or he was in this war now with England and France, although he beat France pretty quickly, but he had all this area to occupy and defend and so on. Well, then Stalin starts pressing demands. And Giesler says, if Hitler had agreed to what Molotov demanded, he would have betrayed Europe. And this was at the point here where Hitler realized he had to take on Russia too. And those who say Hitler should not have invaded Russia are saying that it would have been okay for the Russians to take over Europe, because that's where Stalin was moving. He was taking over little by little. And of course, we know at the end of World War II, he took over all the area that had been handed over to him. And that went behind what's called the Iron Curtain. So for Hitler, the Occident was at stake. He thought that if he could win over the German people and then the whole of Europe, he could persuade everyone that this social revolution of his was in their interest, and he could ruin Lenin's and Lenin's successors quite openly announced intent to Bolshevize Europe with support of Asia. But he was not able to do that, was he? He thought he could do that. He hoped he could do that. He was trying to do that because he saw, from his point of view, that was what was necessary, nothing less, because he knew what Stalin and what the Soviet Union had in mind. But it turned out that England and America, behind England, and France going along with it, hated Germany so much and so much wanted to defeat Germany that they overlooked this other, and they even made allied with the Soviet Union in order to do that, in order to beat Germany. And that's not the plan that Hitler had, but that's what turned out. That's how it turned out. So, this other way of looking at it, that Hitler shouldn't have invaded Russia, he was so reckless, and it's because he hated Slavs, is just so simple-minded and simplistic. And then this goes on to talk about what happened in the Balkans and how Italy foolishly attacked Greece. At that time, though, Hitler learned that there were 150 Russian divisions facing the German forces on the border of, almost to the border, and of Germany, and that they could have, if Stalin wanted to, at any time he could have cut Germany off from all their raw materials that were down in southern Russian areas, southern Russia and the Balkans. He had the manpower to do so, And he was trying to take control of all that area so that whenever he wanted to, he could do that. And Hitler was at, in a, you know, he wasn't in the best situation, but he could have just abandoned Europe to Stalin and the Soviet Union, which is what it would have been. And people who say that wouldn't have been are just wrong, because it would have been. That's what the plan was. So Hitler was trying to do the best for everybody, and he was getting no cooperation. And Italy then attacked Greece on its own, and he does say that, Wieser does say that the Italian attack was brought on by the deliberate snub and break of neutrality by Greece. So Greece was had claimed to be neutral, and then it went over to the British, and so the Italians then attacked Greece, but they weren't up to it, and this really angered Hitler, but there was nothing he could do about it, because he wasn't consulted. They just did it, and they lost. They're being beaten, and then Germany had to send all these forces down there to save that situation. It took some time, and that's the well-known situation where the plans to invade the Soviet Union were put off for a month or so, which was a bad delay. It ended up with Germany occupying Belgrade and Yugoslavia and so on, and then they started their partisan warfare with the leader Tito and with the help of the British and all of that. So he had another front down there in the south, which he didn't want to have, but he had it under control. And then he went back to deal with the Soviet Union, with the Russian, and they found this threatening readiness of the Russian divisions and armies at the German and Romanian east borders. No hesitation was possible. Our preventive stroke met battle-ready armies of the Soviets. Our attack did not surprise the Russian leadership. On the contrary, we were surprised by the deeply stacked Russian forces, the strength of their artillery, and especially their incredible mass of tanks. And that was an offensive setup that the Soviets had there, not a defensive. They weren't defending their land. They were preparing to attack. So Hitler ended up in not only a two-front war, which he had tried to avoid, but he was in an all-sided battle, in a three-front and then even on more sides than that. And Giesler writes, he always expressed the opinion that we should never have allowed ourselves to be involved in such a situation. The Napoleonic Russian campaign stood menacing and terrorizing in front of his eyes. Don't you doubt that I carefully considered all phases and all events Napoleon had to experience in Russia, he said to Giesler. Why then still our attack? He's like, he knew better. He knew he didn't want that, but still they attacked. He said, Hitler says, we were condemned to that struggle. It was our fate. Now that might sound a little vague, but I take that as meaning that Germany, being the position, geographical position that it was in the center of Europe, on the, you know, bordering the Eastern Europe, and at this point now they are right on the border with Russia, since Poland had disappeared, and Germany, by being the kind of a people and nation that it was, and Hitler being who he was, they were trying to deal with this very dangerous enemy to European life, and they were not getting any help with it. He didn't convince these others of his vision and to go along with him. Instead, they were surrounded, and that's why he means it was their fate. It was fated. They didn't ask for it. They didn't, you know, they didn't want to get into this situation, but there they were, because they're the only ones, in my view, that was willing to do anything about it. So, especially, or was willing to look at the whole picture, not just their own interest, but in this case, this was also in the interest of Germany itself, because Germany was going to be the first victim of Stalin. So, especially Then he says, time was against us. By all means, we had to try to avoid an extended war. So he felt that, he says, when England staked all its hopes on the Red Army, for us, there was only one possibility that remained, to eliminate that Red Army and force the Western powers into peace before America's interference with all its consequences. He knew America was going to come in. He had very little time. He knew that. But he said he thought, you know, with the surprise element, he could, if they could destroy that Red Army. Well, there was a kind of a long chance, but he was the person, he could see how it could happen. But and they almost did, but that winter, here was something that was really bad luck, you know, bad destiny. That horrible first winter was so fierce, it just stopped them cold. And then the Russians had time, the Soviets had time to regroup and to improve their defense, and to get into a defensive posture and so on. And then things started, became very difficult. And he didn't manage to destroy the Red Army in a short period of time. And then he got bogged down in all this, the United States came into the war and so on. But his idea was, this is from Giesler, says, it was equally important for Germany and Europe's future to confront the Bolshevik threat. We could not confine ourselves to the defense of merely the German territory. Only by a preventive stroke could we succeed in carrying the campaign into the vast regions of Russia. The idea to drive the Reds, to drive the Bolsheviks back behind the Urals, that was the idea. To drive, because you couldn't depend on Slavs or the Russians to do it. They weren't going to do it. They had to drive, he wanted to drive the Bolsheviks back behind the Urals, and that was the idea of taking over that whole territory. The ideas of having this land for German use and plans and so on, I think came after they were engaged in this struggle, and so you started seeing all the possibilities if they won, you know. So I don't think, though, that was the reason. There's no way to believe that Hitler would have gone into a two-front war, and after he got involved in the Balkans, and then he knew it was a three-front war, and he knew the United States was in wait. He wouldn't have done that just to get some land, just for Lebensraum. That, you know, just wouldn't, that just isn't, wasn't the reason for it. The reason was that he felt he had to destroy that Soviet threat, which was a real threat. Now, Bob from D.C. says he disagrees with that. I don't know what his idea is or what you know how he argues for that, but it would be interesting to hear. He says these things, but then when we talk about really getting into it, then he backs out and says, well, all we need to do is we need to get rid of the Jews in our nations. Okay, you know, I don't want to go into this anymore. So I don't think he doesn't have it worked out. He's just got some things that he thinks. So I'm going to stop here. I've you know, left out some things, but this is a generalized case for Hitler's high purpose in what he was doing, not the low purpose of hating Slavs and wanting to destroy Slavs and enslave Slavs and steal all their land. I didn't get a chance for my mid-show music again. I never do. I'm going to go over to my mailbox just in case and check it. Ladies and gentlemen, oh, there's somebody, and I'm going to see. Okay, here this person writes, Hitler's attack on the Soviet Union was one of his greatest acts. Good for him. The Soviets had a far larger army and always remained a serious threat to Germany. Furthermore, Stalin, in a closed-door session, he doesn't have time to find the exact details, he says, but in a closed-door session in early May 1941, had stated his intent to attack Europe. Okay, May 1941, in a closed-door session, he is saying that Stalin stated his intent to attack Europe. Well, I'm not surprised at that at all. I could believe that. The evidence was also in the new airfields in the western areas of the Soviet Union being built and the forward offensive deployment of troops, which helped Germany's attack since the Soviets were not in a defensive posture. That's all true. Hitler's defeat was his weakness as a tactician, failing to be mobile and flexible, as Manstein points out. Well, there's a lot of people who point to Manstein's criticisms, and I have never looked deeply into that. I'm aware of them, but so there you go. Now, that's the end of the Poland part. Now I'm going to move on to Serbia. And boy, I have a lot to say about Serbia, but I felt I needed to make that case for German innocence in light of Poles. Someone accused Serbs of fighting against Hitler in both wars, 1 and 2. This was on Daily Stormer. This person named Serb, who used to post there a lot, but I mentioned in a previous program that he seemed to have disappeared, or maybe he took on a different name. But now he returned just for this one time here because he says he's not going to post anymore. But because somebody said the Serbs were stupid and had fought against Hitler in both wars, and that was not the, you know, not a good thing for them to do, Serb answered and said, "My country always fought for its own existence against any invader, no matter who or how big he is. Most people here comment from a country that fought against Hitler." Well, because most countries did fight against Hitler, he's right about that. And he's saying that all these people commenting are idiots. He's right about that in a lot of cases. But what I find interesting here and very telling about Serbians is saying that they fought for their own existence. They didn't fight for anything else. They didn't fight for any high-minded European principles ever. They don't think that way. They think in terms of themselves, and we are Serbs, and they wanted to expand their territory, and they had little wars and stuff against some of their neighbors. They didn't always do so well, though. And I'm going to go through their history here. But they always allied with Russia. This thing that I talked about once before, I'm going to bring it up again. It is a booklet that came out in 2014 in French by a French journalist, Philippe Simoneau. And it's called No, Germany Was Not Guilty. And this Simoneau reveals that Germany got a bum rap, in his opinion, and that Germany, we're talking now about the First World War. This is the First World War. Because the Serbs fought against Germany in the First World War and against Germany in the Second World War, as I already said. And now we're going to the First World War, and Germany's blamed for that too. It's just amazing how wherever you look, you mostly see historians say that Germany and Austria were at fault for the war. They were mostly at fault, more at fault than anyone else, which is just beyond belief for me. But this man, this Frenchman, disagrees. And he talks about all the atrocity propaganda that they dreamed up against the Germans. And then he blames the United States for entering the war in 1917 on the stupid premise of making the world safe for democracy. And what a free country Germany was, even though it was a monarchy, it had universal suffrage, and Jews had all kinds of freedom there in Germany and so on. And it's just saving democracy, says, has nothing to do with World War I whatsoever. But he says about starting the war, he says Wilson was at fault for all of that, but Wilson didn't start the war. And who should take the blame for that? This Simoneau believes the real culprits in starting the war were Russia and France, and that they had the motive, and Tsarist Russia believed war was almost essential for its economy. It would help its economy. And then, you know, he's got arguments for all of this. That for Russia, its only access to the Mediterranean and to world markets was through the Straits and the Bosphorus, and it had seen what happened when the Straits were closed, so it wanted to make sure it had control of that. And in 1912, during the Ottoman Empire's war with Italy, the passage was cut off, and Russia believed that having control over Constantinople was a vital national interest. So it looked for a short European war that would provide cover for it to seize the Straits. And France, for its part, was still smarting from the humiliation of losing Alsace and Lorraine to the Germans back some years before, and its defeat in the Franco-Prussian War in 1870. And so they had, at that time, they had some people in power there who were aggressive revanchists. They wanted to recover this lost territory, and they were very militarist. And one of them was Raymond Poincaré, who wanted war with Germany. He openly wanted war with Germany. He was a statesman at the time in France, and probably a member of the parliament and so on. And he thought that a two-front war, Poincaré in France thought that a two-front war between France and Russia on the other side would take care of Germany, and they couldn't lose if they did that between France and Russia, you know, getting into a war with Germany. So that was they were scheming for that. The French were heavily investing in Russia's railroads because the Russians needed to improve their railroad system for one reason, to shuttle their soldiers to the front, because they were all over their country there, far, far away. But the Tsar had access to 2.5 million troops, and the French thought that was just fantastic. So they were helping them to improve and increase their train system so they could deliver a quick, decisive blow. But one thing that's very important is that a document was found after World War One that many of the France's most important documents disappeared. They were removed from the files and never seen again. But they missed a few documents, and one of them has been brought to light, and Simoneau quotes it, translates it here, or it's translated. It's dated September 2nd, 1912. It's 2 years before the war began. It's addressed to Poincaré and a Colonel Vignal from the Second Office of the Military General Staff. No, this Vignal predicted that a war begun in the Balkans would put France and Russia in good position to beat Germany. So they thought the place to begin this war was in the Balkans. The Balkans were always a hotbed. There was a lot of revolutionary activity, a lot of criminal activity, a lot of unrest, and people fighting one another and so on. So they'd get something started against Austria or Germany in the Balkans. Other documents from Russia that have been brought to light show that the assassin Gavrilo Princip and his group of conspirators, the Black Hand, were actually paid by the Russian military attaché in Belgrade, and that the government of Serbia, which was allied with Russia, was aware of this and aware of the plot to assassinate the Archduke Ferdinand and his wife when they traveled to Belgrade. And this was JFK assassination or something. And in January 1914, a French journal, a well-known journal, Le Matin, had reported an extraordinary concentration of Tsarist forces at the Prussian border, that Russian forces. The big concentration in January 1914. So they were ready for it. And Poincaré went to Moscow on July 23rd, a month after the assassination. It's not known what was discussed. There's no records of that meeting. You know, there's always diplomatic records of all these diplomatic meetings and so on. But sometimes they get rid of them. And sometimes they take things out of them, delete and, omit certain things and so on. Or as we've seen, you know, when they black out certain parts of it. But they say, it's, he says that we know the Germans were not the first to mobilize their troops after war had been declared. So war was declared, but nobody had mobilized yet. But the Russians were ready. They were able to set themselves in motion a week after Poincaré's visit. And that visit was in, July 23rd. Poincaré went to Russia on July 23rd. 1 month after the assassination. Oh, I forgot that I had said that. And they mobilized. The Russians set their war machine in motion a week after Poincaré was there. So that's what they talked about, no doubt. And immediately, as soon as the Germans got news that Russia had mobilized 13 corps for war, then they mobilized. The Kaiser mobilized the next day. But the Russians were the first ones to do it. And this fact was falsified later in order to make it look as though Germany struck first. So this was the part that Serbia played in starting World War I. They weren't the organizers of it, but they were more than willing to go along with it and play their role. There's more here that I could read about, but I think I've said the important part. So that was... And, you know, Poincaré became premier of France, and he was always very anti-German. And he, in 1923, sent troops to occupy the Ruhr, and he was wanted Germany to pay very heavy reparations and so on. He was just very, very tough against Germany. He hated Germany. So this is the way this stuff works. I have some things against Serbia, I'll tell you. I mean, I admit it, you know, I'm going to admit it. I didn't always, but I've talked about this in a previous program, so I'm not going to repeat this. But I'll just say that I see Serbia as possibly could be called the problem child of Europe. Maybe a lot of others could be called that too. But Serbia is small and is not very influential, but it always plays a kind of a bad role. I read through the entire history of Serbia, which I was going to go through, but it would take a long time, even though I think I'd hurried through it. But well, I'll just say, you know, it formed in the beginning of the 6th century, so it doesn't go back forever. But and out of that was the first Serbian principality of with a certain name emerged, and it evolved into a grand principality by the 11th century. And in 1217, the kingdom and national church, of which is called the Serbian Orthodox Church, were established under Nemanjići. And in 1345, the Serbian Empire was established. It spanned a large part of the Balkans. In 1540, the Ottoman Empire annexed Serbia. So they didn't last too long as an empire. And the Serbian realms disappeared by the mid-16th century, torn by domestic feuds and Ottoman conquest. The success of the Serb... And this is basically from Wikipedia, and I knew, reading that long page, that Serbians had written it. You know, I mean, if you have... Everybody can get in on these pages if you want to, on Wikipedia, and so pages like for Serbia or for Germany or for whatever, people who have an interest in that will put it the way they want it to be. So I do not see this at all as being anti-Serbian, but actually being pro-Serbian. What I'm giving you here. So Serbia disappeared in the 16th century. But then in 1817 there was a Serbian Revolution against Ottoman rule, and that marked the birth of the Principality of Serbia, another principality, I guess, which achieved de facto independence in 1867 and finally gained recognition by the great powers in the Berlin Congress of 1878. So it was recognized, but it still wasn't an independent state. As a victor in the Balkan Wars of 1913, see, there were wars down there preceding the beginning of World War II. So Serbia was victorious in 1913 in these Balkan wars, and they regained Macedonia, Kosovo, and Raška, which was old Serbia. And in 1918, after World War I, the region of that Vojvodina region proclaimed its accession, its secession from Austria-Hungary, and united with the Pan-Slavic state of Slovenes, Croats, and Serbs. The Kingdom of Serbia joined the Union on 1 December 1918, and the country was named Kingdom of Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes. In 1918, Serbia was recognized as a state by the world for the first time. They shared that state with Slovenia and Croatia. After, in 1945, it became the federal unit with a federal unit within the Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. And Serbia once again became an independent state on June 5th, 2006. Now, Serbia is trying to get into the European Union. They probably will, but they're not there yet. And I think it's a mistake. Why I should worry about the European Union, I don't know. But as I said before, I think a lot of these countries don't belong in it. And I think Serbia is one because they're trying real hard to come up to the standards that are required. And they get a lot of help, and the European Union people overlook things because they want everybody to be a part of it, in spite of the fact of the problems it's going to cause for the bigger states. And yet the bigger states would have the ability to veto or not, and they don't do it. So they obviously don't care about that. So there's something else behind the whole darn thing. But I know that these groups, if they feel they want to be strong, they think that the more people they have, the stronger they'll be. But it's been proven throughout history that that isn't necessarily the case. These countries like this can really cause a lot of problems that aren't worth it. Just like Italy caused a lot of problems for Germany in World War II towards the end. You know, not in the beginning, it was great, but later on. During the Revolution of 1848, the Serbs in the Austrian Empire, Serbia was a part of the Austrian Empire, proclaimed a Serbian autonomous province known as Serbian Vojvodina, and by a decision of the Austrian Emperor, in 1849, this province was transformed into the Austrian Crown Land, known as the Vojvodina of Serbia and Tomas Tamiz or something, in the Banat, also called the Dukedom of Serbia and Tamiz Banat. Against the will of the Serbs, the province was abolished in 1860, but the Serbs from the region gained another opportunity to achieve their political demands in 1918. Today, this region is known as Vojvodina. Yeah, well, okay. And so, you know, I say the Serbs are angry here in 1849 and 1918 because they're being frustrated in their goals at their independence. And in 1885, Serbia was against the unification of Bulgaria and Eastern Rumelia, and they attacked Bulgaria. Well, Serbia and Bulgaria have gone at it quite a bit between each other, and this is also known as the Serbo-Bulgarian War. Despite better weapons and skilled commanders, Serbia lost the war. So I see Serbs as still angry. See, I see Serbs as an angry people, who have the idea, very much similar to the Poles, actually, but in a different way, that they haven't been given a chance, that they're mistreated, and they're always fighting, but they're fighting for themselves, they're fighting for their independence, they're fighting for their nationality, and so on. And that's okay. It's okay. I think that's what people do. But they're frustrated in it, and they're not happy. They're not happy with their lot. And so, in 1903, there was a May overthrow, bringing the Kardordas' grandson to the throne with the title of King Peter I, and he opened the way for parliamentary democracy in Serbia. See, overthrow. They're always overthrowing their governments and so on. Having received a European education, this liberal king, Peter I of Serbia, translated On Liberty by John Stuart Mill and gave his country a democratic constitution. But the Balkan Wars of 1912 and 13 terminated the Turkish domination in the Balkans. Victory led to squabbles about the division of the spoils. And in the second of the two wars, it was Bulgaria who was Serbia's main enemy once again. Or maybe that was the same one that I mentioned earlier. I need to come up to the more modern time. It doesn't really talk about World War I here, but I went through their role in World War I and starting World War I already. So now it's in 1918, Serbia joined, with the Slovenes, Croats, and Serbs. I covered all that. And the Allies in 1918 secured Bulgaria's surrender. Bulgaria was with the Germans and Austria, I guess. Austria, Hungary, Germany. And so they invaded Bulgaria and Bulgarians surrendered. And in the early 1920s, the Yugoslav government of the Serbian Prime Minister, Nikola Pasic, used police pressure over voters and ethnic minorities, confiscated the opposition pamphlets and other measures of election rigging to keep the opposition and mainly the Croatian Peasant Party and its allies in minority in Yugoslavia, in the Yugoslav parliament. Pasic, this was the Serbian prime minister, believed that Yugoslavia should be as centralized as possible, creating a place of distinct regional governments and identities, a greater Serbian national concept of concentrated power in the hands of Belgrade. However, what pushed the kingdom into crisis was when a Serb representative opened fire on the opposition benches in the parliament, killing two outright and mortally wounding the leader of the Croatian Peasants' Party, a man named Radic. This happened in 1928. This I think is interesting because they're so wild down there that they some people will even have a shootout in their parliament, and they kill each other. So this doesn't happen all the time, but it happened on this occasion. It reminded me of a story that Andreas Vesterle told about a certain immigrant from the Balkans who ended up in Milwaukee, where he was living and working as a young man, Andreas. And one day he brought a knife to work, where he worked, and they had a knife fight during lunch break. I mean, this is the kind of mentality and behavior that some people in the Balkans can have. I mean, it's very, very much aggressive, and you say something wrong to me, I'm going to get even with you, and we'll fight it out, and so on. And they do it even at the, to do that at your place of employment is not a very good idea, nor is it a good idea to do it if you're a member of parliament, to do it in parliament. So this is a kind of behavior that you run into. And in 1929, because of this crisis, King Alexander I banned national political parties and renamed the country Yugoslavia. During an official visit to France in 1934, King Alexander I was assassinated in Marseille by a member of the Internal Macedonian Revolutionary Organization, an extreme nationalist organization in Bulgaria that had plans to annex territories along the eastern and southern Yugoslav border with the cooperation of the Ustasi, the Croatian fascist separatist organization. And then we go to the beginning of the 1940s, and Yugoslavia is surrounded by hostile countries. Except for Greece, everybody else has signed agreements with Germany or Italy, and Hitler was strongly pressuring Yugoslavia to join the Axis powers. The government was even prepared to reach a compromise with him. Prince Paul's government was toppled by a British-Russian plot. On April 6, 1941, Germany, Italy, Hungary, and Bulgaria invaded Yugoslavia, and the Luftwaffe bombed Belgrade for 3 days, they say, killing 1,700 people. Belgrade was captured by German forces on 13 April 1941. Well, you know, the reason all this happened was because Germany had created this kind of a pact with all these countries and with Prince Paul of Yugoslavia. And 3 days after that thing was signed, the English manufactured along with the Serbs, manufactured a putsch against Prince Paul and his government and killed him, I think, or drove him out, and took over for the communists, really, and for the English. So Hitler said, hey, you know, we can't let this happen. So he went down there with all his forces and won it back, and that was another one of those things that interfered with the invasion of the Soviet Union. And this may have been on purpose, but so he had to take care of all of that. He was damn mad, I'm sure, and I don't blame him. I'd be mad too. So heck with these people. Wipe them out and clean up and take charge down there. So Belgrade was captured by the German forces on 13th April 1941, and 4 days later, the Royal Yugoslavian Army surrendered unconditionally. So there again, the great Serbian armies surrendered, and King Peter left the country and went to where? Britain, to seek Allied support. The western part of the country, together with Bosnia and Herzegovina, were called the Independent State of Croatia and ruled by the Ustaše. Most of modern Serbia was occupied by the German army and was governed by the German military administration. The northern territories were annexed by Hungary, and the eastern and southern territories by Bulgaria. So everybody got their part. Some others were taken over by Albania and occupied by Italian troops. And Slovenia was divided between Germany and Italy, and also some of the islands in the Adriatic, so went to Italy. So Serbia got to be all divided up again. And in Serbia, the German occupation authorities organized several concentration camps for Jews and members of the Communist Partisan Resistance Movement, while the Serbs accused the Germans of putting Serbs in and killing them in concentration camps, in which they died. But they were for Jews and Communist partisans, which many of them were. And the Chetniks were helpers of the Germans. In 1944, the Soviet Red Army liberated Belgrade, and by the end of 44, all Serbia was free from German control. Yugoslavia is among the countries that had the greatest losses in the war. Well, a lot of it, they were killing each other. You know, 1,700,000, 10% of the population of Yugoslavia were killed. How many did Tito kill? Plenty. So, you know, it was a bloodbath down there. It really was, and it was continued to be at the end of the war too. Well, this is the end, but not the actual end yet. And the $9.1 billion U.S. dollars in damages to that area. I think the Serbs are in large part responsible for a lot of that, because they never would come to any agreements. They're always fighting and resisting. After the war, 1945, Tito became the first president of the New Socialist Yugoslavia, and he ruled through the League of Communists of Yugoslavia. Now, nobody really liked that, but that's what they ended up with, since they were on the side of the British, who never helped him one bit, and the Russians. Now, recently, on March 12, 2003, the Serbian Prime Minister Zoran Dindic was assassinated. Another assassination. The newly formed Union Government of Serbia and Montenegro called a state of emergency and undertook an unprecedented crackdown on organized crime, which led to the arrest of more than 4,000 people. We're getting into the government of the Democrats, you know, and so these were not probably popular with those who today are call themselves Serbian nationalists. This is the others, you know, those who they don't support, who are going along wanting to join the European Union and all of that. The reformers, led by President Kostunica, have been unable to gain control of the Serbian presidency. The reformers, because of the three successive presidential elections, have failed to produce the required 50% turnout. So for an election to be valid, you have to have a 50% turnout, and they didn't get it. So the people are apathetic about that, although they're apathetic everywhere, but not most places don't require 50% turnout. I think that's a pretty good idea, actually. Now, EU integration, Serbia officially applied for European Union membership on 22nd December 2009, and despite its setbacks in the political field, that same month in 2009, the EU unfroze the trade agreement with Serbia, and the Schengen countries dropped the visa requirement for Serbian citizens on 19 December 2009. The very time that they applied, they were allowed to travel around, obviously. They said, okay, you can come without a visa, even though they weren't EU members. And so all these Serbians could go wherever they wanted in Europe and stay there if they wanted, and a lot of them did. A lot of them do. A lot of these Serbian nationalists that you see online, they don't live in Serbia. They live in Europe, and they complain how much they hate the EU and this and that and the U.S. and so on, but they take advantage of it. When it comes to the EU, I'll just give my opinion here. I think that there needs to be an order or a categorization of countries, like into A group countries, B group countries, C group countries. That's what, or any organization that Weiss would establish for Europe. I think there needs to be, and Marcus had talked about an order, and the way I see an order, you need to have A group, B, you need to have a hierarchy of nations. And that's what the EU doesn't do. They don't want to do that. I mean, in practice, some countries, run the thing and others don't. But according to the rules, they're all equal. And so, therefore, they all get to move around. That's a big problem. That's what I started with, that they all get to travel and go into other countries and actually apply for citizenship. They might have to give up the citizenship of the country they came from, but if they don't mind doing that and become a citizen of another country, then you get all this European mixed race people. I know some who, and there's got to be a lot more, but I mean, I know one in particular who calls himself a Serbian nationalist, and he lives in, I think it's in Germany, he never wants to say, but and he's married to a German, half German, half Polish woman, who's, I guess, a German citizen. They have children, so they're German, Polish, Serb, and whatever else mix, and he's therefore doesn't seem to be planning on leaving Germany at all. And there's a lot more, like him. But then they say that then the Serbs are always complaining about how they how Serbia is mistreated and how great Serbs are and how great Serbia is. And then they hate the EU and they hate this. I already covered that. They've been mistreated and they hate NATO and they hate. But what do they do? I'd like to know what they, after what all I've read here, I'd like to know what Serbia has ever contributed to Europe. I don't know of anything except for Tesla. And I don't know that we couldn't have gotten along all right without him. But, I'm not saying he wasn't a good guy and didn't do a lot. He did. That's about it. I don't know anything else that Serbia has contributed in the way of culture or anything, political stability or help or anything. Now, they have a problem in Serbia between the Catholics and the Orthodox. And there's all these complaints. I have this stuff written down here, but I would have to read it all because I don't understand it well enough to just tell you about it. I read it all and I understood it, but I mean I can't sum it up. But it's kind of like the Serbs, the Orthodox Serbs, say that Austria, when it was in control of Serbia, forced all kinds of Serbs to become Roman Catholics, and renounced their Orthodox faith and did some other things to them. And the Croatians, who are Roman Catholic, forced Serbs to believe that they were Croatian, you know, who were living in Croatia, that they are now call themselves Croatian and Roman Catholic and so on. And they say that's, you know, been a like a type of genocide of Serbians. That Serbians have never been able to hold themselves together. They're always going somewhere else because they can't create a organization, state, for themselves. Now, the thing about, and here's getting back to this Gavrilo Princip, the assassin of Ferdinand. And when I read all the time that it is said that the Austrians overreacted by invading Serbia because Serbia wouldn't give them any satisfaction as far as doing any punishment and doing cleaning house in Serbia of all the revolutionary hotheads and so on and underground stuff that was there and also I know what it was hatred toward Austria, that this hatred toward Austria, which was the monarchy over the Serbs at that time, was being encouraged, and nobody was doing anything about it, which led to violence against Austrians and Austria-Hungarian Empire. And Austria wanted the Serbs because of that murder of his son and his daughter-in-law. And let's remember that she was pregnant. That means he murdered not only the heir to the throne of Austria-Hungary, but he murdered the heir to the throne, the second heir, who was in the, you know, still inside the wife, Sophie. He murdered two heirs to the throne, plus the wife who was going to provide more children. So that was quite a bad, nasty thing to do. And Austria wanted, we're back to World War One, you know, Austria wanted Serbia to clean house and do something about it and punish some people. But the Serbia wouldn't do it. And Russia also supported Serbia and wouldn't do anything to help pressure Serbia into that. And Austria finally invaded Serbia. And that was what started the war. I'm now declaring war on you, and I'm now declaring war on you because of that. And Austria is blamed for being rash in doing that. And I understand that you have to keep your head in diplomacy, but I think that was wrong. I think that Austria had, in a sense, every right to do what they did. And just like with Hitler invading Poland, they should have allowed Austria to go into Serbia and do whatever it needed to do to satisfy itself, you know, and take over maybe the government and put somebody in charge who was that they liked, and do that because Serbia was wrong, but people saw it differently, and so we ended up with World War One, and then later we ended up on the same principles with World War Two. Now, I've got something here written by a Serb. I really would like to go through this. It's pretty short. The title is Hitler Hated Serbs Because of Gavrilo Princip. This is a Serb writing this in 2013, November, just about a year ago. The German cruelty, he writes, towards Serbia in 1941 was exaggerated in view of military tactics. That used to be explained by Adolf Hitler's rage because Serbia had not joined the Tripartite Pact. Now there appear interpretations that Hitler was angry because of the assassination in Sarajevo, which, remember, Hitler was angry in the 1940s because of the assassination that took place in 1914. Let's keep this straight. They're saying that Hitler was angry about Sarajevo and Serbia's role in that back then. There are witnesses that have left written records on the matter. Historian Milan Ristovic, again, another professor of the Belgrade University, says, Namely, after news about the coup on March 27th, Hitler fell into a hysteric mood that resulted in hatred towards the Serbs, characteristic for the Austrian public opinion that had been for years, even before assassination in Sarajevo, exposed to anti-Serbian propaganda. He was suppressing that hatred only to get Yugoslavia to join the tripartite pact. So this guy is saying that Hitler had a real hatred for the Serbs because of what they did in starting World War One, but he suppressed that or held that in because he wanted to get Yugoslavia to join his pact. Hitler then instructed Goebbels, who in an announcement over attack on Yugoslavia, or announced the attack on Yugoslavia, that the time has come for Belgrade to be destroyed as well as the Serbian conspiracy corps that has turned against Germany for the second time. So according to this, where they get this, I don't know. But Hitler instructed Goebbels, and Goebbels announced it, that it was time for Belgrade to be destroyed, as well as the Serbian conspiracy corps, because it's turned against Germany for the second time by what it did, you know, in the coup, probably, against the regime of Paul and destroying his tripartite pact with Yugoslavia. So it says the first time was Princeps' assassination, and the second, the coup on March 27th. Yeah. Well, you know, it actually makes sense to me that this might be true. And it goes on to say that the English historian, Christopher Clark, says in his interview with the Vrem Weekly that after the defeat in 1918, they're left within the German leader a lot of the Habsburg hatred against the Serbs. So Christopher Clark, English historian, said that after Germany's defeat in 1918, Germany and Austria's defeat, that Hitler was left with a lot of hatred against the Serbs, which was a Habsburg-type hatred. Hitler said he didn't like the Habsburgs, but he was Austrian. And this is what Clark is saying. And, you know, what he's going by, I don't know, they're going by something like that Goebbels came out with. But let's see if there's more, because I don't remember. Hitler's relation, this is Professor Rostovic says, Hitler's relation toward the Serbs is part of a wider context. There is a postcard in which the top of the postcard has a photograph of the Austro-Hungarian soldiers from World War One, and the bottom of the photograph is German soldiers from World War Two, and there's a portrait of Eugene of Savoy, who at the end of the 18th century conquered Belgrade. On the postcard, there is written, quote, fathers and sons on the same task, unquote. That sounds kind of touching to me. It establishes relation between two different political periods in which there was the same wish, expansion of the German living space to the southeast onto the Balkans, Professor Rostovic said. Well, I don't think that was the reason, you know, for getting living space in the Balkans. But it's possible, because the Balkans were another breadbasket, a good part of it. You know, the Banat was a great wheat-growing area and so on. So I found this interesting, and it makes me almost like it or wish it was true that Hitler held it against the Serbs, and maybe not only the Serbs, but maybe mostly the Serbs, for the World War One, which ended with defeat, and again for the problems in World War Two. So he would have been no friend of them. And, you know, I don't want to appear unreasonable, and I know I appear, I suppose. No, I'm going to say, you know, they're no friend of mine either. And here's the thing. It goes back to that German in the first story that I read tonight, who the Poles are coming and stealing from his town, causing a lot of crime, stealing automobiles and a lot of other things, crossing the river because they have this Schengen privilege and just walking in there and at night and taking things. But he's saying, well, I don't want to be too hard on them. you know, I want to understand, they're unemployed, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, Poland insists on being the independent country and having this big territory. If they can't keep their people employed, it's nobody else's job to do it for them. Maybe I said that up above, but that's what stands out in my mind, so I don't mind repeating it. It's nobody's job but theirs, and that's how I see all of these European countries. I see that they have a right to exist. They have a right to want their independence and to love themselves and to promote their nationality and so on, but they don't have a right to have other people take care of them who are wealthier than they are for reasons of being more responsible people. And so, you know, if you fail your own people, don't throw them off on somebody else, on the others, to take care of them, which is what they're all doing, which is what the European Union is all about, especially since it's expanded itself into Eastern Europe and particularly into the Balkans now. And more and more of them are coming in. It's a drain. It's an imposition on the Western nations. It's particularly an imposition on Germany, and the Germans are afraid to appear to be unlikable or too harsh or something to say things the way they should be said. So, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to say good night to you now. I feel good about what I've said and what I've gotten across. It might have been a little tedious and boring at times to some of you. I'm glad to have tackled this, and I want to thank you for listening tonight. I'm going to check my email one more time just so I don't ignore somebody who wanted to have a comment mentioned. Well, this is from the same one. He's got some details now. I'll read it. It says, Kremlin banquet, May 5th. This is when supposedly Stalin said this. I think it was May 5th, 1941. One of the generals, the director of the famous Frunze Military Academy, was toasting Stalin's genius for preserving the peace of Europe when Stalin irritably waved for him to stop, tottered to his feet, and delivered a second speech of his own. And he said, during the years of capitalist encirclement of the Soviet Union, we were able to make good use of the slogan, while we expanded the Soviet Union's frontiers to the north and west. What slogan? He says, but now we must discard this slogan for the reactionary and narrow-minded slogan, as it will not serve to win us one more square inch of territory. It is time to stop chewing that particular cud. Comrade chosen, stop being a simpleton. The era of forcible expansion has begun for the Soviet Union. This is from Hitler's War, obviously David Irving, in page 382. So thanks for that. Stalin announcing that the time for the expansion of the Soviet Union. So, oh, I'm glad I went to that, because I do want to end with saying that I think that Hitler was correct in his assessment of all of these things. He had exactly the right idea about what was going on and what needed to be done. And it was too bad that he couldn't get other people, enough other people, to see it the way he saw it, and because he saw it correctly. Things would have been so different. So he calls it the forces of reaction, but it's also just those nations, other countries, the allies, who wanted to destroy him and Germany, any competition, rather than to work together for the good of Europe. I think that the idea of working together for the good of Europe by white Europeans is probably not feasible. I don't think people work together. I don't think you can get people. If Hitler couldn't do it, and he had a big head start on it, and he was very, very persuasive. He was, but people would go away, and then they'd back away from what they were persuaded from, because they'd be talked into it with others. But these forces, and the Jews play a big part in it, are always working to undermine that. And so that's why I keep bringing up this problem with this kind of pie in the sky idea of white nationalism in as a process for Europeans. So anyway, ladies and gentlemen, I'm really done in here, so I'm going to say good night for now, and thank you for listening tonight to the Heretics Hour on October 13th, 2014. See you later.